This is 91.3 KUAF, where you've heard NPR News for more than 32 years, and where Sunday through Thursday nights from 8 to 10, you can hear Of Note with Katie Hendrickson, our own classical music program. You can find out more about all of our programs at KUAF.com. Later on today's show, this year's One Book, One Community project isn't just about words on a page. Antoinette Grajeda will introduce us to a performance opening tonight that's in conjunction with the novel The Book of Unknown Americans. That's later on today's Ozarks at Large. First, a local nonprofit called Serve NWA wants to build emergency shelters in South Fayetteville to provide temporary housing for some of the homeless population in the region. The New Beginnings Community, as it would be called, would be built on 5 acres of land just south of 19th Street along South School Avenue next to the Seven Hills Homeless Day Center in Fayetteville. Right now, the property belongs to the University of Arkansas, but Serve NWA is raising money to buy the land. Kevin Fitzpatrick is the director of the university's Community Family Institute, and he's part of the board of Serve NWA. He says he got the idea for New Beginnings about 5 years ago.
The key to keep in mind is that right now, there is nothing. The only thing that exists in that area of South Fayetteville are locations where people essentially are living in third world conditions.
Fitzpatrick says the idea of emergency or low resistance shelters is to remove as many barriers to stable shelter as possible by giving the homeless more options.
The problem that we have is thinking that somehow we can move them out of the woods into an apartment. And that jump, that leap is too big. There's too much to go along with that.
Fitzpatrick says at first they would start with security fencing around the community. That would include about 20 micro shelters. They would be simple A-frame structures with very minimal electricity that possibly runs on solar power.
I don't liken them to be tents or huts they are a micro shelter. They are a place for someone to actually have a safe, secure place to sleep at night, to store their belongings, to have an address, to have access to Wi-Fi, to have access to bathroom facilities, to running water.
The residents would also have access to gas grills and shared fire pits that together would create a communal cooking area. Fitzpatrick says they would then bring in various services like health care and job training. The Planning Commission tabled the proposal until their next meeting on Monday and asked for a more clearly designed layout to address safety and security concerns. Fitzpatrick says Serve NWA recognizes that, but he also makes this point.
Right now, at present, there is no safety and there is no security on this property. So anything that we bring to that piece of property would be a vast improvement.
Fitzpatrick says there's also no evidence that crime in the homeless population is higher than crime in the general population.
While there may be criminal arrests among homeless persons, those arrests and crimes committed are typically misdemeanors. They are not violent felonies, and they typically are related to the consequences of their living circumstance and or the circumstances of the places, the cities where they live.
Fitzpatrick says the goal is to give people their dignity back and to give them between 30 and 120 days of stable shelter so they can move into more permanent housing elsewhere. It is the time of year when farmers around Arkansas burn their fields after the harvest. Farmers have a legal right to burn off residue from their fields, but the fires also spark controversy among those who say they're creating a public health hazard, especially for people with asthma. Ann Kenda with Arkansas Public Media takes a look at both sides of the issue.
The winds are just right on an October afternoon. Flames crackle on a farm in Osceola. Farmers are burning off rice residue to clear the fields for the next season. It's carefully timed to keep the smoke pointed away from a nearby highway.
We do it because we have to. It's not because we want to. If any farmer had the choice and we had another option, I don't think anybody would want to burn. But it's absolutely a necessity.
That's farmer Mike Sullivan in nearby Burdett. Some of his fields show the blackened remains of a recent burn. He acknowledges that burning fields doesn't win local farmers any popularity contests, but says there just isn't a choice When you compare the time, cost, and outcome of burning versus clearing the fields mechanically, often the straw is so high that it cannot be removed without at least some burning.
Basically, when we burn it, it's just a quick flash burn across the field, and about 50% of the straw is all that's removed by the burn. And so all that burn really does is just gets it to a manageable state.
The farmers face plenty of criticism over the smoke. It's often visible from highways these days. Swifton resident Linda Norris says she can't get away from it, even in her own home.
In my house, with the windows shut, the doors closed, sometimes I wear a mask because my eyes are running, my nose is stopped up because of the smoke.
But field burns are legal, according to David Moore with the Craighead County Office of Emergency Management.
Correct. Yes, there is a state law that governs burning, and the farmers, if they have a row crop and there is residue, then they have the right to burn that as long as there's not a burn ban in effect in the county.
But some say it's time for Arkansas to consider banning field burns. Pediatrician Warren Skog demonstrates a portable air quality machine.
Push it to go on. Oh, looks like a 1960 transistor radio, but it costs considerably more than that, let me tell you. You push the button, pulls air in, applies a laser beam, and measures diffusion.
Skog steps outside the children's clinic in Jonesboro every afternoon to get a reading on air quality. The air gets a good measurement this time. But Dr. Skog says there are many days when pollution flares up and registers at an unhealthy level for sensitive groups.
Sensitive groups mean those with chronic lung disease, those with asthma and allergies, and all children. They breathe more air for their weight. There's more minute volume, and they have developing lungs, and they are susceptible as a group.
Skog thinks farm smoke will someday be thought of like secondhand smoke and recalled the days when smoking was allowed in public places and how unthinkable it seems now.
We've been working for two straight weeks, an average of 14 to 16 hours a day. We haven't had a
Back on the farm, Mike Sullivan says farmers already use as much caution and courtesy as possible, but not burning just doesn't work.
We burned it about the middle of September, and this field is ready for a soybean crop next spring. And if we would not have burned it, there would be 6 inches of straw out there, and we wouldn't have done anything for the soybean crop.
The field burns will be visible around Arkansas wherever rice is grown for the rest of the fall. In Mississippi County, I'm Ann Kenda with Arkansas Public Media.
Arkansas Public Media is a journalism collaboration involving Arkansas public radio stations, and it's funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You can learn more at arkansaspublicmedia.org or the Arkansas Public Media Facebook page.
I'm Robin Young. Poet and author Kwame Alexander has just released his first young adult novel. He drew from his own experiences to tap into the mind of a teenager.
I remember going to my girlfriend's, or who I thought was my girlfriend's house, and my best friend opening her door. And that totally just destroyed my world.
Next time, Here and Now.
Beginning at 1 this afternoon on 91.3. And ahead on today's show, Jennifer Lynn's lifelong work on her book, Shanghai Faithful, Betrayal and Forgiveness in a Chinese Christian Family.
But I started as kind of a memoir. There was a point in my lifetime that was really the catalyst for this whole odyssey of mine. And my father called my book my obsession, and he's right. It was an obsession.
Jennifer Lynn was recently in Northwest Arkansas and talked with us about her book covering five generations of her family. That conversation later today on Ozarks at Large. And by the way, last call now for the 56th annual Fall Color Tour tomorrow in Jasper. It begins tomorrow at 9 a.m. at the Newton County Courthouse and then traverses a route through the Ozark St. Francis National Forest and Buffalo River. Cost is $6, and you should probably bring snacks, a jacket, and comfortable shoes. Camera isn't a bad idea either. One of the stops on the tour is a lunch stop at the Ponca Elk Center, where there will be food for purchase. If all of this sounds better than what you already had planned for tomorrow, you can find out more information by calling the Big Piney Ranger District at 284-3150. 284-3150.
The Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette, the region's daily newspaper, offers local news where we live, play, and work in Benton and Washington counties. It's one newspaper for one region. The Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette, online at nwadg.com. Additional support provided by Highlands Oncology Group, helping patients fight the battle every day with a team of cancer specialists in both Benton and Washington counties. Services include radiation, CLIA-certified labs, a multidisciplinary lung clinic, and a lung cancer screening program. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com. American humorist, comedian, author, and radio contributor David Sedaris returns to Walton Arts Center Tuesday, October 24th at 7 p.m. Sedaris will read selections from new and unpublished works with his signature deadpan prose. A book signing of his new book will follow his performance. WaltonArtsCenter.org or 443-5600 for tickets.
The University of Arkansas's annual One Book, One Community program invites the local community to read the same book in an effort to create discussion around a particular issue. This year's selection, The Book of Unknown Americans by Christina Enriquez, tells the story of Latino immigrants living legally in Delaware. The novel explores their family lives, aspirations, struggles, successes, and failures. In conjunction with the initiative, the Latinx Youth Theater Project will perform tonight and tomorrow. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda attended the group's rehearsal earlier this week in Springdale, and she has more on what audiences can expect from the actors' latest production.
Freedom is being loved.
Freedom is being listened to.
Freedom is stress-free.
Inside the dimly lit theater of the Arts Center of the Ozarks, seven young actors stand in front of desks and recite lines. This is the Latinx Youth Theater Project. Playwright Ashley Edwards says the initiative's goal is to give Springdale youth a voice through writing and theater.
The point of it was to create a positive change in the community, give the underrepresented artists, specifically the Latinx community, a voice, and to create social change, positive change, community awareness that we about cultural heritage and ethnicity, and also address some of the hardships and struggles, stereotypes that they have faced while growing up in this area, but also looking at it with a positive lens and how can we change this.
The Latinx Youth Theater Project was established in the spring as a collaboration involving David Jolliffe, the Brown Chair in English Literacy at the University of Arkansas, the Arts Center of the Ozarks, and Northwest Arkansas Community College, with support from the Walton Family Foundation. Initially, project participants wrote poetry for several weeks that NWAC Theater Coordinator Ashley Edwards transformed into the play Follow Me at T.O. Sam. The devised theater piece tells the story of a group of young Springdale writers and activists who, when approached by a novice Latino politician seeking their support, discuss issues related to community and ethnic identity. The company mounted its production earlier this year at NWAC, Art Center of the Ozarks, Crystal Bridges, and Theater Squared's New Play Festival.
After that, it received so much amazing response. It was all free and all of that, that David Jolliffe and I worked together in Kathleen Trotter here at Art Center of the Ozarks to ask for another grant, and Walton Family Foundation wanted us to do another season. So this summer we put that together. Most of the group was interested, and we came up with another grant proposal for another season, and that's what we're doing now.
Before work gets underway on a second season, audiences can get one more look at the material that inspired Follow Me at T.O. Sam. Tonight and tomorrow, the company will mount two performances in conjunction with the U of A's One Book, One Community initiative. These two shows will take scenes from the original play and expand them. Actor Samuel Rivera Lopez says they're tackling some issues that can arise in a classroom setting.
Something that we've come to notice is that a lot of tension exists within the classroom because students aren't allowed to say what they want to say. And so, like, freedom of speech doesn't really exist within the classroom. And so when there's a lot of things that happen that might demean certain things that that a teacher might say something or a student may say something, but nobody's allowed to say anything back because it's not in the right setting for somebody to speak out about it. And so it's like, if we could go back in high school and talk about the moments that made us feel uncomfortable and like talk to a teacher about it, how would we react? And so it's like holding up the mirror to another possibility that should exist within the classroom.
The viewing experience will not be a passive one. Following the production, audience members will be invited to participate in the conversation.
There's going to be a talk back to talk about kind of like the issues that we talk about in the play, but also kind of like feedback from the audience saying, what would you like to be talked about? And kind of like, what are we saying that you know, affects you or in some way you like that we're actually bringing this to light? Like, it's really about having a conversation that hasn't really been had. Yeah. Well, out in the open. I'm pretty sure these are conversations that people have with people they care about and trust, but it's rare that you have a public discussion over topics so large in a small community sometimes.
Director Jules Taylor says everyone involved can take away something from experiencing this production.
This whole project is such a socially relevant experience for everyone, for them to tell their experience, for the participants to be able to express themselves and their individuality and their collective culture. But it's even more of an experience for the viewing audience, you know, to hear it and to think about the things that they're saying.
Michael Landman, head of the U of A's MFA directing program, directed the original performances. Because he's unavailable for this week's series of shows, Taylor says she's acting as a substitute director.
It's been a privilege for me being part of it, just to walk in almost as an observer, right? You know, until very recently, I've just been observing everything and getting to know them and listen to them. And they're sharing some stuff, you know? It's brave of some of the things that they're saying and that they're sharing.
In the short time she's been with the company, Taylor says, as a white person, she's learned so much.
And so much that I was not aware of. You know, like there's this great term that I have recently learned called microaggression. And I'm guilty of it just like everybody else. And so it's been a real, like, honor, really, to get to hear what it means from their perspective and have them explaining it. And then I've incorporated into my life and into my consciousness just in the last couple months of what that means. And it's helped me to understand myself. And a lot of us, you know, we think, oh, I'm the least judgmental person ever. But we don't always hear the things that we say or the microaggressive little things that are the subtle things that we put out there.
The Latinx Youth Theater Project will perform twice this week in conjunction with the U of A's One Book, One Community initiative. Both performances are free and open to the public. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Tonight's performance begins at 7 o'clock at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville. Tomorrow night's show is at 7 in the Faye Jones School of Architecture Auditorium on the University of Arkansas campus. More information available by emailing David Jolliffe at djolliffe@uark.edu. Also tonight, Folke Gerritsen, the director of the Netherlands Institute Istanbul, Turkey, will deliver the latest talk in the Stigler Lecture Series in Archaeology and Anthropology. Yesterday afternoon, he came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to give us a preview of his address tonight about work at Barjin Heyuk in northwestern Turkey, where 8,600 years ago, some of the first people to make agriculture their way of life lived.
In the bottom of this valley, if you know where to look, you'll see a little bump in the landscape. It's a flat valley, and you'll see a little bump there under fields. The whole valley is covered with agricultural fields, and also this site is covered by fields. But this bump has been caused because people over a period of many centuries lived here and continued to build on top of the debris of earlier generations, and that created this hill, which now rises about 4 meters above the landscape. And then if you walk across the site, you'll see on the surface some of the remains. You'll find shirts, pottery shirts, that then to the archaeologists already tell you that this is a prehistoric site where about 8,000 years ago people lived.
8,000 years ago.
8,000 years ago is when the people that we were interested in and that we researched abandoned the site. So they came there 8,600 years ago and left again 8,000 years ago.
So what has been, what do we know about these people that were there centuries ago?
Well,
millennia ago, yeah.
Millennia ago. So they lived there for 600 years. And during a fairly big part of that time, it seems, from what we know about the region, that they were among very few sites, among very few communities living in that region at that time. So we got the impression that these were pioneers that moved into this region, that were the first farming communities in northwestern Turkey, established their settlement, their community there, and that after maybe 200 or 300 years of occupation, satellite settlements started to appear in the region. And what we didn't know when we were starting to excavate there, but what we sort of like were lucky with, was that this site has these very early levels that could tell us something about how people moved into this region, how they settled down there, how they sort of colonized this region with a food-producing economy. So these were people that we think came from central Turkey, southeastern Turkey. There, there had been a switch already in earlier millennia from a forager economy, from hunting and gathering, to food-producing economy with domesticated plants, domesticated animals. And at some point, this new way of life, this farming way of life, started to expand, started to appear in new regions. And as we all know, farming is the main subsistence economy across the world.
Folke Gerritsen is the director of the Netherlands Institute, Istanbul, Turkey, and tonight he delivers the latest in the Stigler Lecture Series in Archaeology and Anthropology. His talk begins at 6 in Gerhardt Hall on the University of Arkansas campus. We'll hear more from that conversation next week on Ozarks at Large.
On the next Fresh Air, John Green, his popular young adult novel, The Fault in Our Stars, about a relationship between two teenagers with cancer, was adapted into a film. The main character of his new novel, Turtles All the Way, is a teenage girl with OCD whose intrusive thoughts get in the way of her life. Things John Green has to deal with, too. Join us.
Fresh Air, 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. every weekday on 91.3.
Support for 91.3 comes from Arcom Plus, providing digital and offset printing, graphic design and promotional items, and a variety of business services for jobs of all sizes. Located just off College Avenue at 461 East Township in Fayetteville, Arcom has been locally owned and operated for over 25 years. Printing, NWA.com, or 444-7711. The Arkansas Educational Television Network Foundation is providing free estate planning booklets this week as part of National Estate Planning Awareness Week. Estate planning is one of the most overlooked areas of personal financial management, and this booklet will help users organize their financial assets and think through personal goals. AETNFoundation.org for information. Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art's blockbuster exhibition, Chihuly in the Forest, continues through November 13th. Featuring innovative works in glass and neon by renowned artist Dale Chihuly, presented in the museum's new sculpture forest. CrystalBridges.org for tickets.
Jennifer Lin's book, Shanghai Faithful, Betrayal and Forgiveness in a Chinese Christian Family, is an investigation into her family's history. Five generations of history. When she was first introduced to the idea that would become her book, she was a college student with no idea what a trip with her father to China would mean. Last week, Jennifer Lin was in Northwest Arkansas, and she came to the Carver Center for Public Radio to discuss her work. After 30 years of research and writing, she says finishing the book was more difficult than beginning it.
Finishing was excruciating. I worked at the Philadelphia Inquirer for 31 years. I first went to China in 1979. I really started reporting the book from that first trip. I was 20 years old. I was a senior at Duquesne University, wanted to be a newspaper woman. And so I really started putting together the family story then, sitting my father down and saying, Dad, tell me the story. Tell me everything you know. So I literally worked over my lifetime trying to assemble and mine the family history. And then the finishing of it was difficult. I left the Philadelphia Inquirer, 2014 it was, in order to finish writing the book. And the writing of it took me about 2 years to do.
So the cataloging, the reporting, the oral histories, get that down. And then you had to sit down and say,
I got to write it. I have to pull it all together and assemble it. And it took a long time to figure out how to assemble it because the book spans 150 years. But I started as kind of a memoir. There was a point in my lifetime that was really the catalyst for this whole odyssey of mine. And my father called my book my obsession, and he's right. It was an obsession, and he's partly to blame. My dad left China in 1949. He was part of the great diaspora of people who left. And in 1979, after Jimmy Carter renewed relations, he wanted to go back home. He wanted to see his sister and his brother. So two of my sisters and myself, we went with him. And it was really that trip that triggered this whole thing, because when we got there, we stayed in the home where he grew up in Shanghai. And at first, it was very happy and joyful. And then I went to bed, and I remember waking up the next morning and seeing my father. And he looked, it was this look on his face that I'll never forget. And it was really that moment that this all started, because he looked at me, he goes, God, this is so depressing. And he had this look of fear and shock and sadness all wrapped up into one. And what had happened was the night before, when we all went to sleep, he stayed up talking with an uncle. And an uncle pulled him aside and said, do you have any idea what happened to us since you left in 1949? And the truth of the matter was we were clueless. Like my grandfather, who spoke fluent English, would write to us every single month from 1953 until the late 60s. And my mother saved those letters. And so he would tell us about life in the family and, you know, who was sick, what trip they took, what they had for dinner. But he really couldn't tell us what was happening. And so it was only at that time, at that trip, when Uncle George pulled him aside, that Dad began to learn some of the details of the family life, particularly during the Cultural Revolution. So that was this period from 1966 to 1976, when it was chaos, basically. And his family was really targeted for harsh treatment, and particularly my grandmother, so my dad's mother, yes, she was targeted. She was interrogated. She was beaten. She had to confess her sins every day, kneeling before her neighbors, and it was just a really horrific time, and Dad didn't know any of it.
It's a lot for someone to digest in one evening when you think you're going halfway across the world for one thing, and it's loved ones.
I write how he vacillated between being happy to see his family and just sinking into this depression, and I could see it. But what was really interesting is, you know, when we went back home to Philadelphia, so this is 1979, and my dad's a doctor, and maybe it's the doctor personality, but he kind of took what he knew, put it in a box, and put it far away. He couldn't go back in past. He couldn't ease the pain of his mother, so he moved on. And maybe it was because I was becoming the journalist that I would become that I couldn't let go. And I just became obsessed with finding out, okay, what happened to them? And once I figured out what happened to them during the Cultural Revolution, it's like I kept getting pushed deeper and deeper into the past. And a lot of what makes my family history kind of unique is that they were Christians, five generations of Christians. So I wanted to know, well, okay, who was the first, and why would someone in China, a culture like rich with Buddhism and Confucius and Taoism, why would someone convert to Christianity in the first place? So I had all these questions. You're a journalist. You know, we're like five-year-olds. We right. Constantly ask why? So I was propelled by the question of why, you know, and I kept going back.
How confident were you that you'd find out why?
Oh, I had no idea.
Because if you asked me to find out, or most people,
right,
five generations ago.
Right. So I had no idea whether or not I would find out. And what made it really hard is this. I tell the story as narrative nonfiction. It's not scholarly. I'm not a scholar. I'm not a theologian. I'm a journalist. I tell stories. So I was able to start by interviewing those around me and broadening the circle. And that brought me back like 70 years, 75 years. But what about like 150 years? So I had no idea whether or not I'd be able to do it. And what I did is I did a deep dive into missionary archives. I traveled from England to up and down the East Coast, you know, Harvard, Princeton, Yale Divinity School, the Episcopal Archives in Austin. I went to the Shanghai Municipal Archives. And I really had to rely on those people from the past to help inform me about my family. So the good thing for me as a historian was that my family, they were aligned with the Anglican missionaries. And the Anglicans are wonderful record keepers. Mm. So I was actually able to find out about what life would have been like in Fujian province in the 1800s when my great-great-grandfather, who was a fisherman, went to work for the Anglicans as a cook. So I was then able to recreate his life based on a lot of the missionary accounts.
What is that like? It's almost as if they're not ghosts, but you're kind of
finding ghosts. Yeah. And so the first convert, the great-great-grandfather, you know, I was able to go to the Lin Ancestral Hall in a rural, fishing village in Fujian, where they have a lot of the archives. So the Chinese are big genealogical record keepers. So in this little ancestral hall in a coastal village is a thick book called a Japu. And in it, you know, I was able to find the family tree. And so it told me about my great-great-grandfather. It told me when he was born, the hour that he was born, the year on the Chinese calendar, which you can then convert. And it told me about his son, and it told me about then his grandsons, one of whom was my grandfather.
How do you keep from getting sidetracked, or is it all information that you're gathering along the way?
So I love to get sidetracked. Right. Getting sidetracked is the fun part. I mean, I just get lost in my research because I love it. I mean, I love the hunt. I was a reporter. I was never an editor because reporters have more fun. And I did some investigative report, and I just love the hunt and the research. And so every you know, turn I took that took me down an alley that may have been a dead end in terms of my book was fun. It didn't matter that it didn't yield anything. So that's why it took me so long, though. That's why, you know, this process that started in 1979 didn't end until this year.
How much did you know about China in 1979?
Nothing. You know, I grew up in the 60s and the 70s. My mother is an Italian-American from Camden, New Jersey. She raised us. My dad was too busy.
He was a doctor.
He's a doctor. We didn't live in a Chinese community. We didn't celebrate Chinese holidays. I didn't grow up speaking Chinese. I knew little. And, you know, in the 60s and the 70s, it just wasn't cool to be ethnic. You know, I grew up with the Vietnam War playing in the backdrop. So it was really this trip in 1979 where it just blew my head. I mean, I just, like, realized that this is a country that I'm tied to. These are people who are my relatives. Now, you have to remember, from 1949 until 1979, there was a bamboo curtain. Right. And even though we could write to the family every month, and they could write to us, we had to assume the letters were being opened and read by the authorities. So my father had to be cryptic on certain things, and the family was cryptic to us. Like, my father was sending money back home, and we had a code. It was Aunt Mary's birthday gift. So my grandfather, when he would get nervous, like, because he got shunted aside from his church job early on, he would say, where's Aunt Mary's birthday present? So we had to be circumspect. And when my dad joined the military, my dad in 1955, after he got married, he enlisted in the Army because he wanted to show that he was a proud American. He had become an American. But he couldn't tell his father back home that he was a captain in the Army. This was just after the Korean War. It would have caused them even more trouble.
If he had just written.
Oh, even just, yeah, just written. He could not tell his family that he was a captain in the Army.
Did you see a change in your father after that first visit?
You know, what's really interesting and kind of puzzling is it, as I said, it became an obsession for me. And I went back then in 86, and then I lived there from 1996 to 1999. And I go back like every year. But my dad never wanted to go back. It's like he wanted to see his siblings. His father and mother by that time had passed away. And he just didn't want to go back anymore. They ended up immigrating. His sister went to Australia. His brother went to California. So he would see them. But he had no interest in going back to China, which is puzzling a bit. And for me, it's just all I wanted to do. After that trip, you know, I was at Duquesne University. I was a senior. And I knew that I was going to one day work in China as a foreign correspondent. I just had to do it.
Did you start to think about your identity differently during this? And were you, if so, were you aware as it was happening?
I don't know if I thought about my identity differently. It's just that I thought about my identity. Whereas before, I don't think I did growing up. I mean, again, you know, as a teenager, I really didn't give it much thought other than I was different. My dad was different. He didn't take us to, like, the Eagles football games or the Phillies, you know, like my best friend's father would. Dad, you know, he tried, but, you know, he just wasn't into American sports. So, but it was after that trip to China that I really became much more aware of identity, ethnic identity, and wanting to learn what mine was.
So you said finishing was much more difficult. You're having to put this history that you've accumulated and discovered into narrative nonfiction. What responsibility do you feel when you're telling the stories of people who have gone on to make sure it's right, to make sure it's as representative as possible?
Enormous responsibility. Yeah. And complicating it is these are my relatives. I'm not writing about strangers. And many of these relatives are still alive. And the ones who are my age, you know, I want to make sure I get their story absolutely correct. It's an enormous responsibility. It's one I always felt, even as a reporter. You know, as a reporter, you're telling people's stories. And I took that role very seriously as a journalist. So writing this book, you know, that's why I, you know, as a reporter, I tended to over-report stories. And I over-reported this. I mean, I could have maybe written it 10 years ago, but I wanted to get it right. And so with some of my relatives, particularly the ones who are my age, I let them read the chapters about themselves beforehand. That's not something you usually do as a reporter, but this was too important.
Right.
And I wanted to make sure I got it right. And really, they made very few changes. And some of the relationships were kind of difficult and complicated. And it was difficult for them to have to relive it. One of my cousins, for instance, was a piano prodigy. And during the Cultural Revolution, she was in the conservatory in Shanghai. And she was caught playing Mozart one night. And Western composers were banned. You weren't allowed to. So her conservatory classmates, the next day in school, you know, they captured her. And they tried to break her hands with a ping pong paddle because of what she did. And she said, like, don't tell me that this is wrong, you know, and they, you know, it was very difficult for her. And then she had to read about it. I had to be truthful to the story. And it was hard for them to relive some of these incidents, particularly during the Cultural Revolution, to have to read about the house being ransacked three times in one night by Red Guards, to have to read about my grandmother being interrogated and accused of being an enemy of the people because her brother was a very famous religious figure by the name of Watchman Nee. And he's very well known even today. People today still read his writings, his books. But because he was in a prison and accused of being a counter-revolutionary, during the Cultural Revolution, it was guilt by association. So it was really because of him that the family suffered the most.
Any advice for someone trying to find out about family, especially family that, you know, just a couple generations back is from another country, not to write the book, but just...
I tell everyone I talk to, all groups, take your grandfather, take your relatives, and talk to them and record it and write it down. Save those oral histories, because once they're gone, it's lost. I'm so glad I started this process when I did as a young person. And over the course of the last 40 years, I've interviewed my father and all of his relatives many, many times. My father unfortunately passed away in August, and I'm just so glad that I was able to record his life in a way that it deserved. So, that's just write it down, record it, don't lose it. And then, you know, build it into a story. Everyone has a story. Mine is very dramatic, but everyone has a story. Everyone has an origin story.
The name of the book is Shanghai Faithful, Betrayal and Forgiveness in a Chinese Christian Family. Jennifer Lin, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Jennifer Lin is the author of Shanghai Faithful, Betrayal and Forgiveness in a Chinese Christian Family. She was in Northwest Arkansas last week, and during her visit, came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Additional support provided by David Adams, designer creator of fine jewelry. This season, David is featuring reticulate metals and patinas in silver and 18 karat with bezel set diamonds, plus gemstone cuff bracelets. All pieces handmade at the Fayetteville Square location. DavidAdams.com for more.
Tomorrow on Ozarks, a hootenanny in the Furman Garner Performance Studio. Musicians, singers, instruments, and a one-of-a-kind jam session to take us into an autumn weekend on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3.
Is Arkansas Works in jeopardy? Governor Asa Hutchinson's final answer is no. This is the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. On Tuesday, Governor Hutchinson met with reporters in Little Rock, and one of the topics on the table was health care. He sought to lay aside the fears that President Donald Trump's decision last week to end federal cost-sharing reduction payments to insurance carriers would hurt the more than 300,000 individuals who receive health care under the state's popular Arkansas Works program. The informal press conference at the state capitol came less than a month after Hutchinson held a similar meeting to announce he was putting his full support behind the Graham-Cassidy bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act passed by former President Barack Obama. But after that bill failed to gain support in the U.S. Senate, President Trump was compelled to sign an executive order 1 week ago, saying he would increase health care choice and competition by halting cost-sharing subsidies in the individual marketplace under the ACA, informally known as Obamacare. The governor emphasized to reporters that Arkansas Works will not be impacted by Trump's executive order. He said he studied the issue over the weekend, and the cost reduction to the cost-sharing payments will not adversely impact Arkansas Works. Wesley Brown has much more on the governor's question and answer session with reporters in a story online. You can find it at our sister website, talkbusiness.net. This is the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Last month, Colliers International Arkansas, the state's largest commercial real estate and property management firm, announced a merger with Irwin Partners, a full-service commercial and investment real estate firm. Both companies are based in Little Rock but have second offices in Northwest Arkansas, Colliers International in Rogers and Irwin Partners in Fayetteville. The deal became official October 2nd, and 9 Irwin Partners employees joined Colliers International's workforce of 96. Steve Lane has worked in Northwest Arkansas for 25 years and is the managing director of Colliers International's office in Rogers. I had a chance to sit down with him recently to discuss the merger. Steve is known as a retail specialist within the commercial real estate industry, so I also asked his opinion of Walmart's announcement of a new headquarters in Bentonville, as well as the ongoing chess match between online and brick-and-mortar retailers. Steve, a couple of weeks ago, the acquisition was announced between your company and Irwin Partners, Little Rock-based company, like Colliers, but with a Northwest Arkansas presence. What is the benefit of that, and how will that impact your company? How does that make you better?
So I think overall, statewide, it was a real good fit for us with the people, with the culture,
relationships they were bringing to the table. So all those things were a great fit. In Northwest Arkansas, we're bringing over Tom Reed, Reed & Associates, primarily an appraiser, but Tom's just a great guy, great relationships. His daughter Katie manages the steel building for us. And then Matt Brown, of course, just another great fit from a people standpoint, and he works with the George family portfolio.
This has been my favorite question to ask, as you can imagine, the last month or so. Give me your reaction to the announcement by Walmart that they would be building and investing in a new headquarters in Bentonville. Given your background with Walmart and your long background in the commercial real estate industry in this market, how important is that going to be for this region over the next 8 to 10 years?
So, wow, that was big. I think even those of us that have been in the business around here for a long time, I think it's hard to gauge the magnitude of what that's going to mean for the area. But, you know, I've worked with people from inside of Arkansas, a lot of outside of the state investors. It seems like a big question has consistently been, what would happen if Walmart moves away? Which, for those of us who have been here for 25 years, seems a little silly, but it's a real question to them. So for now, for that question to be answered, is just really huge. Straight, great statement that Walmart's made to the market. And I'm not sure, you know, Paul, that anybody really knows what that means for 10 or 15 years in the future, but it's going to be good for all of us.
Right. The announcement was so big, and it just led to so many immediate questions of what's going to happen to the home office and when are they going to build and all that stuff. So I think because of the long-term nature, certainly you're right, plenty of time to answer those questions. Also want to get your take on, you know, the retail industry as it relates to the commercial real estate industry. I mean, you've kind of been known as a retail specialist in your career in this market. What's your opinion of the chess match between, you know, online retailers versus brick and mortar retail? Is there a noticeable impact in your world and what you see and do every day?
Well, I think, you know, from a kind of global standpoint, the big box retail world is certainly changing. Shopping centers are getting smaller. There's a different tenant mix. There's a lot of different retailers, smaller groceries, fitness centers. The pets guys seem to be flourishing for some reason. But I think those retailers that can adapt and still provide what the customers want will have success. They talk about omni-channel. I think you've got to have a digital online presence. But if you can provide a good bricks and mortar experience, then you're going to be successful as well. But it's certainly changing.
All right, Steve, always a pleasure. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That's Steve Lane. He is the managing director of the Northwest Arkansas Office of Commercial Real Estate Brokerage, Colliers International. I'll have a story on Lane in the upcoming issue of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal. It's due out October 30th, so be on the lookout for that. After the break, a look inside the C-suite. Details after this word from our sponsors.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas, and it shows in your banking experience. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. That's because First Security is 100% focused on serving customers all across the state and nowhere else. It's local banking with local commitment. First Security. Bank better. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. And OneCom. OneCom, providing voice and data solutions that adapt to today's demand with tomorrow's technology. Communication tools that integrate mobility with the desktop and merge wired networks with the wireless technology. More at one-comm.com or 479-715-8800.
Northwest Arkansas has its share of strong corporate leaders, and for the third consecutive year, we have recognized 10 of them with our C-Suite Award. The honor acknowledges regional business leaders for their contribution and commitment to the community and their exceptional professional performance. You can find profiles of this year's class in the current issue of the Business Journal. Just go to nwabusinessjournal.com and you can check out the digital version for free. And that's all the time we have today for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Be sure to bookmark our website to keep up with our daily reporting of regional and state business and political news. You can also keep up with us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
Eric Garner's death is a familiar story. An unarmed black man is killed by police. No one is charged. Journalist Matt Taibbi wanted to understand why.
Not just how these incidents happen in a few terrible seconds, but how they happen over the course of years and decades and repeat over and over and over again.
His book, I Can't Breathe, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 3 to 6 on 91.3. And 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Apple Spur is a service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Another brand new edition tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m. on KUAF. We'll end today's show with Barrett Baber and a song he did for us here called Drop Dead Redhead. He'll be at Basin Park in Eureka Springs Saturday evening beginning at 5. You can learn more about us at ozarksatlarge.com, at kuaf.com. You can learn more about Barrett Baber, by the way, at his website, barrettbaber.com. Have a great rest of your Thursday.
Had the radio up with the windows down, driving no blue all over town. Slow down, cause the lady's coming up on the right hand side. I slowed down, said, what's your name? She jumped in, said, do you got what it takes? She was a drop dead redhead, turning me inside out. I was I'm dead.